Good evening. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. Paradigm Shifters is an interview show about people that are making a difference on the planet. And our special guest tonight is Stuart Mooney, who has made a tremendous difference since the early 70s in people's mental and spiritual health, and is now very involved in what is called the phenomenon of the oneness movement. So I'm awfully glad that you had time for us. Welcome to the show, Stuart.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I see here, before we really get into the oneness movement, which is a pretty exciting movement right now, but I see that you were one of the first, it says here in quotes, you were one of the first Western clinicians to use yogic meditation in the treatment of mental illness.
Yes, that's true.
Can you talk a little bit about that? It said you did some landmark research into the effects of mantra meditation on the human brain, and I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, well, I kind of backed my way into spirituality. So what was happening was that I was in a program to become a psychotherapist, a psychologist. And this was at a teaching hospital affiliated with Yale Medical School called the Institute of Living. And it was one of the two most famous research hospitals in North America, the other being Menninger's Clinic. And they got a grant to take a look at three techniques. One was Jacobson's relaxation. One was alpha biofeedback, and the third one was one called transcendental meditation, or the TM technique. And so this was actually funded by Johnson and Johnson.
Oh, really?
They do a lot of funding of really creative research.
Well, you know, I would have been not, I wouldn't have been aware of that. That's pretty interesting right there.
Yeah, they actually have a foundation called Robert Wood Johnson, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funds a lot of cutting-edge research.
Wow.
So anyway, this was way back in 1971 and 72, and our research, we had an electrophysiology lab with EEG, EMG, EKG, and all of the physiologic parameters. And we also had a huge pool of psychiatric patients. And what we wanted to do was to look at these techniques and see whether they would impact certain types of mental illness, mental processes in the brain which weren't healthy. And so they threw me in the laboratory, and I tested a lot of people physiologically. But I also taught them the techniques, and particularly I was in charge of teaching the TM technique to many of the clients at the hospital. And that was fascinating because then you had this kind of interaction between the Maharishi, who wanted it done in a classical Indian way with a ritual of puja, and everything done in Sanskrit instead of English, and which was kind of over the top as far as the psychiatric hospital was concerned, but they consented to it. And so there I am finding myself with patients who were actually pretty sick, the first ones I did. And I'm there using flaming camphor, singing in Sanskrit, and chanting out
And they're
these
going,
mantras.
what?
Yeah, what is going on? I'm asking myself. I
Am
went
I
to
having
medical school
hallucinations
for
or
this.
what?
And so, and they'd have, for instance, they'd have the orderlies standing outside the door because some of the patients were violent. And I'd be, here with this flaming camphor going around, and I was wondering what the hell I was doing there.
It's
But
a
it turned
pretty
out,
interesting scenario if you had it on video.
yeah, it was, pretty unbelievable, particularly in 1971, because it was pretty conservative then.
Oh, yes.
People didn't even know what a mantra was.
Yeah.
But what was fascinating about the research was what we were seeing in terms of shifts in the brain and how the brain was functioning, because basically what was happening is it was demonstrating a shift towards parameters that were exactly opposite to flight or fight or flight.
Oh, wow.
Or stress. And these shifts in the brain towards more healthy brain waves, less sweaty palms, changes in blood gas, which were really positive, all of these changes would happen in less than 10 minutes.
Oh, wow, really?
A drop in overall oxygen consumption of 17%, which was unheard of, and yet the blood gas level of oxygen remained even. So, you know, you weren't losing oxygen in the blood. The body was just resting more.
Hmm.
And we'd never seen that before. It was all brand-new territory.
Hmm. Pretty exciting.
It was fantastic. And at the end of the research, my boss asked me what I was going to do, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to go take, you know, go into analysis and do all that. And he said, why would you do something like that?
Mm-hmm.
He said, here we have all this research which shows a knowledge that we have no idea about, that these people have, and he said, I would pursue that.
Well, tell me, did the people, the actual people who were mentally ill, did they change? Were their adaptations different? Were their personalities different, their lives?
I could, I'll tell you a single story very quickly.
Okay.
So my first patient was a catatonic schizophrenic, pretty sick, who was a Vietnam vet, and who would, for days at a time, become frozen in place and look, you know, like a lamp, just frozen in place.
Wow.
And so I taught this person the TM technique, did the puja, asked them to chant the mantra and take it mentally, which, you know, I had no idea whether they did or not. And then when they left, they took the client back to the unit. About a half hour later, I see this client's psychiatrist running down the hall at me. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I regressed the guy even further. and the guy runs up to me, grabs me, lifts me up in the air, spins me around. He's a really big guy. And he said, what did you do? He said, what did you do to my client? He said, the client came back to the unit, and on the unit for the first time, the client smiled and was aware of where they were. And he said, I've been working with this client for 3 years and had no response at all. And you do some simple technique, and this technique gets through to them. I want to know more about it.
Wow. How exciting.
So it was very exciting. And I was very surprised. But, you know, 40 years later, I've taught in India, I've taught at hospitals in India, and I've seen some pretty amazing things.
Hmm.
So I'm pretty comfortable with that type of shift happening.
Well, I just want to say this. It's interesting that one of the experiments that's done with TM is when they did, 3 months of meditation around the White House and that area, I think it was around the White House, in that area, the violence level dropped. And I'm going, there must be a correlation there as well between the psychiatric difficulties and the brain impact from doing the meditation out in public, right?
Yeah, and there's a group coherence that develops. If you have, you know, brain waves are an electronic pulse, and if you have enough people with this resonant electronic pulse, and that pulse is calming to the atmosphere, it's going to entrain to other people's brains, and other people's brains are going to calm down.
Excellent, excellent. So let's jump ahead. I'm very excited about this research, but let's jump into the oneness phenomenon.
And this is, it's a great way of entering into oneness, because what oneness does is it takes this coherence factor, which Maharishi touched on and expands it rapidly. So that what this is it's just, to me personally, it's a much more efficient vehicle for producing this shift in the brain, which people have talked about for thousands of years, called awakening or enlightenment. Or, you know, every culture has a name for it. Samadhi, Satori, Nirvana, the Holy Spirit, the Chi. All of these things describe a process in the brain, in the nervous system, which shifts one's perception of reality so that one sees, a person sees themselves as not localized in the body, but actually experiences themselves as the totality of their experience, inside and outside, a state of oneness, or the Maharishi would call it unity. And this experience is a natural, comfortable experience that can be lived by Westerners. And that's an important point, because it looks like you have to have a turban, love beads, and a diaper and live in a cave somewhere in order to have this experience. And that's just not true. And what you're seeing is you're seeing the emergence of what I call a golden age, in which these states of consciousness can be lived comfortably in modern society.
Is it something, let me see now, when we're talking about nirvana or awakening and so on, can people maintain that state?
Sure. It's just a style of functioning of the nervous system. And what happens is that it develops gradually. So one would start having what's called awakened states, in which there, because it's a state of functioning of the nervous system, it's organic. It's completely organic. It's not a state of thinking or any type of anything requiring mind or mental gymnastics. It's not that. It is a shift in how the sensory mechanism of the brain senses reality. And usually what we do is we don't sense, we make sense. The mind steps in and tries to understand, and so it fragments its sensory experience. What this state is it's sensing without making sense. So it's sensing without the interference of the mind creating a narrative and trying to understand what's going on. And we've all had it. Between 0 and 18 months, we had what's called the experiential mind. And the experiential mind is just the capacity to experience the innocence of a child without trying to interpret or understand what we're experiencing. That's why a child has so much fun, because everything is fresh and brand new, and it doesn't have all kinds of names and explanations and understandings. A child sees things fresh. That's why Christ said you have to become innocent like a child to enter the gates of heaven. All this is it's the child's nervous system reemerging in an adult. So you have a socialized adult. And on top of that, you also have the experience of the innocence of every moment being fresh and brand new and clean and not complicated by a million past stories which don't exist anymore.
So right if there now, was, if, but, so the Vietnam vet or the PTSD is not neutralized, but it's no longer running the nervous system, is that it?
Usually we live in a story, and the story is mediated by a bunch of neural network loops, and these neural net loops are just kind of old stories. And what happens is that when we have a new experience, we go into like a filing system and we look at past experience and place it on a new experience. And that's called reflective mind, and that kicks in about 18 months old. Hmm. It's the mind of stories and explanations and language. So what we end up doing is we end up living a reheated life, a life where we live our past over and over and over again and never get a fresh look at the present moment. Hmm. Awakening or enlightenment is the present moment without the interference of the past. It doesn't mean that you go Alzheimer's and lose your past. You still have it, but it doesn't interfere with your experience of the moment. So the moment is brand new and fresh and complete.
So we need to have that a number of times to maintain its condition or its situation?
It gradually infuses into the nervous system. Hmm. And it infuses because of something I call grace. And maybe that's, we could call it the organizing intelligence of the universe. The intelligence that created this entire universe also can organize the nervous system so that it can experience the universe in a whole holistic way. Hmm. So that rather than my experiencing myself and my body as separate from everything else, I experience everything as a singularity, everything as part of me, as my own body. And that's very, very important because right now, we're all isolated from each other. It's almost like a pathological state. Mm-hmm. And this separation creates anxiety. It creates depression, violence. All of these things are caused because of the sense of separation between humans and between our world and ourselves. The oneness experience, the Diksha, the grace transmission is a way of very efficiently and very quickly shifting the brain to experience this state of oneness.
And oneness is actually the fact we all share a common self, right?
Yeah. Realistically, what happened was a long time ago, there was an anomaly in the brain which developed over time, which gave us this sense that we're somehow separate from our reality. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at it just in terms of quantum physics, this is all a singularity, and nothing can exist outside of its relationship to all other things everywhere. And all the state of oneness or unity or enlightenment is the reemergence of the experience that we are, in fact, at our source, all one.
And so awakening is getting to that awareness?
Awakening is the development of that awareness. And that awareness is not a mental state. It's a state of consciousness. So you might say that it's an enhanced version of experience that's different from waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Hmm. So in that sense, you might say it's an altered state because it's an enhanced experience where the sense of separation between oneself and the rest of the world drops off. It's a very comfortable way of living. I think a lot of people have this misperception that you turn into some sort of vegetable, which you don't. In fact, the
virtual that you would separate from everyone else because you're in this bliss and you don't comprehend anymore.
Right, and that's a misnomer. That's a perception that the mind made up. Hmm. It's actually the exact opposite because no longer do you have a psychological self that is constantly beating you to death. saying, oh, you better not do this or this will happen, watch out, or something that's creating doubt all the time. That psychological self is gone. It disappears. And all there is that's left is you and the things that need to get done. You and your life. You and your responsibilities. So you do them much more easily because there's no BS going on in your head about should you or shouldn't you, or about this sense of loss. If you do one thing, then you'll lose the other thing. The conflict completely ceases. And all there is you and this moment and what needs to get done. Hmm. And it's awesome because you can end up, you know, like I can finally appreciate my grandkids mm-hmm. and my kids and everything I do, even washing the dishes or taking out the trash, has its own value and its own gratification, and it becomes fulfilling because there's nothing to interfere with the experience of doing those things. There's not a narrator saying you should or you shouldn't do something. There's just doing.
And, Stuart, that's actually in the Vedanta, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely. All these people are describing the same experience.
Right.
But it's an experience. It's a state of consciousness. It's not a state of mind. Okay? It's not, you don't get to it by having some preconceived notion of how to be holy or how to be spiritual or how to be silent. Those are notions, those are invented, those are made up. We're talking about something that's an actual shift in the way that one experiences reality. Mm-hmm. So it's a neurophysiologic shift, it's measurable.
Hmm. So let's go back into the phenomenon of Diksha, which for people who don't know is the kind of the transmission of that awakening, is that right?
Yeah, it's a transmission of the grace that precipitates awakening. And I like it for many reasons. The most important is that it really does not interfere with whatever path you're on. Because to me, Diksha, or the grace that Diksha provides, is like the lubricant that makes spiritual practices work better. So it makes anything work better. It doesn't interfere. If you have a teacher, stay with that teacher. You need to stay with that teacher. All the Diksha does is it enhances whatever path you're on.
Because it enhances your central nervous system or your brain patterns to...
Exactly. That's it. You're right on. It enhances the ability to sense and experience the path you're on more deeply because it is something that's in the nervous system that gets enhanced, not in mind and in thinking.
So it started... Go ahead.
The thinker remains the thinker. And the belief systems remain the belief systems, and they're ingrained in a person. So they don't need shifting. What gets enhanced is the ability to see the deeper truth and experience it neurophysiologically through the senses, what the deeper truths of each teaching are.
So how did this one get started? Is Bhagavan in India?
Bhagavan brought this out. Actually, this knowledge has been around for thousands of years. And
it's like Shaktipat? Is it like that?
It's somewhat like Shaktipat. I think it's just that, to me, after living with all these teachers, what I noticed that's different is each Shaktipat has a kind of an intention and a qualitative intention behind it that reflects the teacher themselves. And so I would say that this one has one single intention. Aman Bhagwan had one single intention, and it's very, very clear-cut, and that's to produce awakening and enlightenment. And And I've spent a long time with all of these teachers, over 40 years. And I have to step back and say, and I've taken a very neutral approach up to about 12 months ago, that this is producing more enlightened people than anything. There's nothing even close to it. It's produced about 10,000 enlightened people in the past 12 months. That's unfathomable on this planet. Nobody's ever done that before. And this is not enlightenment light. This is very clear cut. They sent me to University of Pennsylvania to have research done on my brain mm-hmm. as part of this study that Andy Newberg was doing, and he's real famous. He's from What the Bleep and The Secret. He's the leading researcher on enlightenment and how it looks in the brain. And he wanted to look at all our brains. So the Dalai Lama sent some of his senior monks, and there were yogis, and there were people in these states from all over the world who we all had MRIs done with a radioactive dye contrast medium to see what our brains looked like. And the most fascinating thing is all our brains look the same. Everyone who was subjectively describing the oneness of reality also showed the same shifts in the brain. So it is organic. It is a state of consciousness.
So all the people in the research project were not all Diksha people. They were all enlightened
people.
That's
right. They were all enlightened people. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting to me, it helps validate what Bhagwan has been saying all along, that this is, and what Maharishi would say, enlightenment's a state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's a state of functioning of the physiology of the brain. It's not something that has to do with belief, mood, or mind. It has to do with the way the nervous system is assimilating data from the outside world, the way it's processing. Usually we take in about 40 million bits of data per second, and by the time it gets massaged and processed and thought to death, by the time it gets to the brain, we only get about 2,000 bits out of those 40 million. All the awakening does is it produces a shift in the brain so that we actually experience more of the 40 million bits per second that our senses are taking in, so we get to sense more.
Uh-huh.
We get to experience more of the child in us, because the child was pure sensory. When my little granddaughter or grandson run around, they're sensing life in a very, very intimate way. There's not even a sense in them of separation between themselves and whatever they're doing. They become whatever they're doing. The universe is still their body. Hmm. That's a sensory experience. So you're sensing more instead of making sense. Hmm.
Well, I'm reading, I have an article here called Oneness Phenomenon and What is to Come in 2011 and Beyond to... I don't know if it's 2:34:10, but in any case, this is about Sri Bhagavan, and it's a webcast transcript from him. And he's talking about, I don't know where he got his sudden, it must have been a vision or something, or an awakening in him, but he's really got some wonderful visions that are coming up about how many people are going to be touched by this and how it's going to awaken our entire species. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that Bhagavan is of his time. In this time, everything is in cycles, including the human experience of the divine.
Right.
And we're coming into an up cycle anyway. Lord knows we've been in a pretty low one, pretty materialist. Okay, and that's why you're here and I'm here today, because there's more light in the atmosphere and more people are becoming aware of it. Mm-hmm. So let's just call that more light, more grace, more divinity in the atmosphere. So now people are actually able to hear what's being said. And this natural enhancement of grace, and then you have somebody with this skill and intention of Amma and Bhagwan towards producing awakening, this natural increase in light, and also some of the spiritual technologies that Amma and Bhagwan are bringing out, and you combine them together, those three factors, and you produce this kind of magic mix, which is producing a lot of awakening.
Are they just downloading it?
They're just, it's like the vehicle for it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just it's timing. It's like riding the wave, mm-hmm. and plus the capacity to intend the enlightenment, which is very important for a teacher to be able to intend it, and then these rare spiritual techniques, which have not been available for thousands of years, are all coming out as a kind of carriers of this grace, which shifts the brain. Because the bottom line to all of these paths is it's got to produce the big enchilada. It has to produce awakening. It has to produce enlightenment. Hmm. A lot of my friends have been on the path as long as I have. They've been on it for 40 years, and they've gotten, like, lost along the way. And they're in the middle of just doing practices without even believing that it will ever produce the awakening that they got into it. It was the reason they got into it in the first place. Hmm. It's just kind of all gotten lost, and people have lost a lot of hope. And all I'm saying is, hey, this is real, this is working, and the other thing is that the state it produces is practical. It's practical for Westerners. It's not going to keep you sitting in some chair somewhere drooling a lot. It's going to get you up on your feet.
Functioning.
See, people have the misperception that it's something like an acid trip or it's some kind of totally spaced out of this world state, and it's not. It's just not. It's the virtual opposite. Mm-hmm. It's an applied state. It's a state where there's nothing in between you and your world. You are your world, so you work through it very, very efficiently. That's why a lot of these saints, you see how incredibly, you look at people like Amici, who are incredibly active, and you can be incredibly active in this state because there's no more resistance. There's no more I sense talking you out of doing things. You just naturally do them and they get done.
Well, what are the techniques? What kind of techniques do they use? Because you mentioned that there was some ancient spiritual techniques. Is that what you called them?
Yeah, there are spiritual technologies that they use that have to do with practices, particularly Indian practices, that haven't been available in a very long time, and they use the quality of grace, which we could call the phenomenon, and they use this phenomenon and plus the various ways of transmitting the phenomenon that are very, very old. So some of them involve rituals or involve pujas.
Pujas, for people who don't know, are... Well, maybe you want to explain them.
A puja is a systematic set of movements using, say, fruit or flowers or whatever. It's a systematic technique to actually draw the support of nature, mm-hmm. or to affect natural laws in a very positive way. And rituals are everywhere in religion. A lot of rituals use light, or they'll use incense, or things like that. But
to call in our connection to all that is, as well, isn't it? Prayer.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way of enhancing the connection to the whole of creation.
Oh, and now that we're into the glossary, we probably should explain to people what Shaktipat is, because we didn't do that either.
Shaktipat is an enlivening of, let's call it, the fundamental parts of the central nervous system. And when this enlivening takes place, then one is able to experience these higher values in life, like the state of oneness or the state of connectivity to all things and all places and all times.
And it is through connectivity, isn't it? It's through a transmission or the sending of that higher frequency from the master to or the teacher, right?
Right. It's an enlivening. So it's like getting a blast of grace that awakens the finer levels of the nervous system. And it starts a process of growth, which eventually ends up in full awakening.
Well, and my experience of Diksha was that mostly it was the transmission of those frequencies, I guess, somebody puts their hands on your head. Is that right?
Right. The basic form in which Diksha is transmitted is through the palms, although Diksha, the grace, which has its source in this phenomenon, which has been going on for thousands of years, can be transmitted anyway. It's being transmitted over this radio show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just being transmitted through the air, so it can use any possible vehicle. Because the state of consciousness is fundamental to every person. The awakened state is actually the source state of functioning of all nervous systems. That's why we had it as a child. It was our first state.
Mm-hmm.
And when you awaken to what's always been there. You awaken to the child that's always been inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something foreign. It's something very, very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thought, you laugh and you go, how did I miss that? But there all the time.
So you're giving a couple of, well, you give a lot of workshops, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So
unbelievable.
Is it fun or is it a lot of workshops? Are they play shops?
It's very, very gratifying. It should be play shops because I get to share all of this, and we also do a lot of these practices
mm-hmm.
that enhance the transmission of grace into the nervous system. And I've just been running like crazy doing these workshops for the past 2 years. I think I counted yesterday and I've done over 50 in the last 18 months.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Well,
and all over the world. So
I'm honored that you have time for us right now. And I know you're going to do one in Bellingham and one in Vancouver, B.C., because I'm coming to the Vancouver one, actually.
Super.
But also, you do energy. You do sessions with individuals. Are they Diksha sessions? Do you do counseling? Is it ever necessary to have counseling once you've had these transmissions?
Part of the growth is a growth in the person. So. It's not just getting awakened. It's also being functional enough to use the awakening. And that means not so trapped in one's story and one's suffering and one's I sense. And so what I do in the private sessions is I sit with each person and share with them individually what they need at that point to take the next step in their growth. And I use a lot of Diksha in a lot of different ways, including the transmission of grace through the eyes, which is a pretty powerful way because it's a direct way. If the eyes are the mirror of the soul, and if the grace is flowing through my brain, it'll flow out my eyes and into your eyes and your brain, and they'll entrain to each other.
Mm. That's That's amazing. I have experienced that. I often find it makes me very shy for some reason.
Well, yeah, but you know, again, this grace from from the source, this grace can be transmitted so many different ways. Sometimes I'll hold people's hands and it'll transmit through their palms. And one thing I want to make clear is I've got nothing to do with this at all. Mm-hmm. This is just the nature of nature. So it's between you and your relationship with your own personal self, with your core.
Do you talk to people then? Do you have any kind of counseling talk kind of situation?
Yeah, that's what I do. Every person is at a certain point in their growth, and I can kind of sit there and I'll share with them where they're at and what steps they can take on their personal journey. And I can also help clarify a lot of misunderstandings, because there's a lot of misunderstanding around the experience itself, and which will retard one's growth if it's not clearly understood. So I kind of really capsulize the knowledge people need to have.
So do you intuit that, or do they talk to you first?
It's a combination of both. It's just, it's there in the air. I just kind of open my mouth and it comes out. Like I said, I'm not involved in this process. Mm-hmm. The process is between the person and themselves, really. Because, you know what, we end up setting our own criteria for our own growth and our own self-fulfillment. Mm-hmm. That's why I always say awakening is going to be in each person's personal terms of what they believe it is, mm-hmm. not in my terms.
So
that sense would be 7 billion different awakenings for 7 billion different people.
Well, that's a lot of work, but then I guess it's kind of like that now, 7 billion unawakenings in many ways.
Yeah, it's just going to be a natural process, and that's what Bhagwan keeps talking about, and that's what all these great saints, if you look at all of them, they're all saying, you know, we're coming into a very, very special age where the ability to have these higher states is going to be much more easy. Mm-hmm. What you're going to see is you're going to have family members, relatives, neighbors. Awakening will no longer be a state mediated by gurus and teachers. You know, my goal is to be out of a job.
So it's kind of a spontaneous rising of consciousness through us?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like a 100th monkey syndrome. There's more and more people go into the state, will produce more coherence in the atmosphere, which will bring more people into those states. Hmm. It'll just happen. It's going to be a natural process. I know it seems far out now, but it's already happening.
Well, it must be fairly aligned with the Mayan calendar stuff as well, isn't it?
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. right on the button with the Mayan calendar.
Mm. So it's really a process of the shifting consciousness that is kind of universal as well.
That's exactly it. So you have this universal rise in consciousness going on anyway, and you take advantage of it, and you kind of hugely enhance that natural rise, which is already happening. And what happens, instead of people just having good lives, they're going to have fantastic divine lives.
Hmm. We're going to get in touch with our divinity.
Yes, which is always there. Our divinity is our source. I mean, we came from the divine. We're an expression of the universe. We're sourced in it. And so why not be able to connect to it in a much more intimate way? That's what this is all about.
So how long does it take for a person, if a person wants to become a Diksha giver or a blessings giver or a oneness, how long does it take? There's a process of going to India for, what, 21 days or something?
No. Actually, it can be done on a weekend.
Okay.
And in fact, anybody who goes to my courses automatically becomes a oneness blessing giver.
Okay.
So it just takes a weekend.
Is there any way that people who are bringing through the divinity, the higher energy, could actually pass on their own emotional state as well?
The beautiful part of the construction of the Diksha is that the Diksha circumvents the personality. Hmm. So what it is, it's the capacity to tap into the whole and have the whole run through your nervous system without your interfering with it. That's been the fantastic part. We've had many, many great saints, but they've not been able to duplicate themselves. Mm-hmm. So that you'd have disciples around them, but the disciples didn't have the capacity to transmit the grace that the teacher had. And that's what really sucked me into this, is that you have normal people who now have the capacity to transmit this immense divinity through their nervous systems without necessarily being enlightened first.
And so it doesn't flush up their shadow selves or their emotional nature.
No, it completely circumvents that.
Hmm. Well, it's pretty exciting. And I saw that there's going to be an African one. They're saying that can change the continent of Africa, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a large gathering in Africa. We're going to also New Zealand and Australia. Mm-hmm. So it should be really, really fascinating.
And it's growing quite a bit. Now, tell us about your book, Stuart.
I have a book called American Buddha. And I wrote that in 2007 about my first experiences with oneness. And also, I just wanted to write a book so that people, all the questions I ever wanted to ask a teacher, I asked myself and answered it, I hope, in a way that Western people can come to understand in their own terms what awakening and enlightenment is. And so that's why it's called American Buddha, because...
And we can get it on your site?
Yeah, and Barnes & Noble and Borders, and it's on Amazon also.
And...
Go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about the Bhagavan, and do you recommend, I mean, you went to the Oneness University, did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did.
Is it getting bigger and bigger as this all goes on?
No, actually, it's not. It's, you know, my experience it's the most beautifully run organization, because there's no real hierarchy in it. It's very, very simple. The university, they just teach the oneness courses. There are monks there who teach the courses. And it's very, very straightforward. My experience there has always been very fulfilling. And given all the teachers and all the courses I've been on in my years, this is the most straightforward and also most fascinating, because you're actually being taught by monks who are actually in very, very high states of consciousness. Hmm. And so it's really fun, and if you can tolerate the trip to India, it's well worth going to Oneness University.
I'd love to go to India at some point. I never have gone, but I guess it's kind of grueling in spots, is it?
It's a very interesting experience.
Do you love it? You've spent many years over there, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, my first trip over, all I could think of as I landed in Chennai was, oh, my God, where's the first plane out of India? You know, what am I doing here? But you end up loving it and loving the people and really appreciating, especially when you get past the surface level, when you can really talk to people about the source knowledge of all of Indian teachings. It's a wonderful experience, a wonderful adventure, and you can grow very, very quickly in that type of environment.
Yeah, I'd love to go. I think it would be really fascinating.
But you really don't have to get awakened. And the bottom line is to experience and get the enchilada.
Okay.
Get the enchilada, then all of us can just go fishing.
So what you're saying is take some and pass it on. It's funny, you talked about the coherence. Remember we were talking about the Maharishi and the meditation over in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
You were talking about the coherence of the mind energy.
Yep.
So it can happen in our families, I'll bet, hey?
Right. Well, if we're, if you look at a DNA, it's like a little coil. It's like a little transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
And so if one person's DNA shifts by having an awakening, then it produces coherence big time in your gene pool, in your kids and your grandkids and your spouse and all your family members.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea.
And that's how this is going to grow. It's going to grow like a thief in the night.
Hmm.
It's going to grow as people entrain to other people's nervous systems, because at the bottom line to all this is there's only one person in 7 billion different forms.
Hmm.
There's just a single human consciousness, and that's really what needs shifted. It's not just an individual or two or 10,000. We need to shift humanity so that suffering disappears from this planet.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea. How do people get hold of you, Stuart, and how do they find out about your, for example, Vancouver phenomenal workshop?
They can connect with me. I have a website, stuartmooney.com, and they can contact me through email at stuart@stuartmooney.com.
And is there a description of the class? Like, what is the class? Is it just a series of exercises, of explorations, or is it a series of dikshas, or...
The class will take you vertical, okay? And it's a combination of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
of information, and direct personal experience. And you put those together, and it creates a very synergistic experience. And I think if you talk to anybody who's been to my workshops, they come out changed.
Yes,
really.
I'm coming with a cousin who was very excited about her going to the last one. But do we get to test our brain as we leave?
Let me tell you, you will know.
You won't
need any test at all, okay? Because in the end, the only bottom line is your subjective experience.
Great. Well, Stuart, this has been very exciting for me. I feel quite peaceful, which I think I'm getting from you. What do you think of that?
I think that's what has to spread around this entire planet.
Yeah. I wonder if you're going to go work on the Congress.
Well, in working on the individuals who elected the officials, you will shift the Congress. You'll shift everything.
I really believe that. I thank you so much for your time. And again, it's stuartmooney.com for more information. And also, perhaps people want to look into, what is it? Oneness Phenomenon. And there's quite a bit online about this movement and the various ways that you outreach, right?
Yeah, you can go to onenessuniversity.org.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a beautiful website and lots of information there.
Lots of articles and so on. Well, I thank you so much for your time and safe travels. We'll see you in Vancouver, BC.
And thank you so much for allowing me to share time with you.
Take care. Well, that was Stuart Mooney. Isn't it exciting to think about the oneness phenomenon? Well, racing through all of our minds around the world so we can truly appreciate and value being one together. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, any feedback to Stuart Mooney, let him know. StuartMooney.com. It's spelled like it sounds, S-T-U-A-R-T, Mooney, M-O-O-N-E-Y.com. And my name is Veronica Entwistle. I'm an intuitive and energy counselor, and I guess I'll soon be a Diksha giver. And you can be in touch with me for further suggestions about our guests or possible guests, or if you'd like a session with me, it's Veronica at Veronica Entwistle, no H in Entwistle.com, Veronica at Veronica Entwistle.com. Thank you so much for listening. Much love to all of you. Remember, we are one.